This is the Wordy Rapping Hood on RPPFM with Tracy Hutchison.
I'm really thrilled to welcome the very first guest to the very first Wordy Rapping Hood, and someone else who's very passionate lover of the Mornington Peninsula, a man who in many ways I think wrote the soundtrack to the Mornington Peninsula, or at least that's how I like to think of James Rain, OAM.
Yes.
OAM.
Yes, Trace.
The Order of the Australian Medal or something it's called, isn't it?
It's the Order of Australia. I don't know what the M is for, to be honest. But it's OAM. You know, I'm allowed to put that after my name.
That's a big honour.
Well, I obviously didn't expect it, or I thought it was I was very surprised when I was told. And I don't know how you get one of them, but I got one.
Well, I think you get one of them for writing songs for a certain period of time and having a few hits and contributing to a great body of work and contributing very much to our cultural life in Australia. I think that's what you get them for, James,
right? But that's what they said, and also for service to the community. So, you know, I was chuffed. It was lovely that they thought of me, and I'm very pleased to have it. That's very kind.
Well, it is great that you're here, and this show, which will happen every Friday at midday on RPP. And
yes, welcome. Congratulations.
I'm thrilled to be here. I haven't been this excited about radio in years.
Good.
It's nice to come home to community radio and come home to the Mornington Peninsula. Of course, former co-host of Dig TV, yourself yours truly, which was the highlight of Australian music television. Just nobody else caught on at the time,
I think. It was, and we had all the right reasons, and it was a great show, and it's a pity that powers that be didn't pick up on it.
Didn't catch up quick enough.
No.
You're here because the premise of this show is all about, I guess, digging into the life and times of one person each week who calls the Mornington Peninsula home. Yep. And I couldn't think of anyone better to start with than you.
Thank you.
Knowing how much you love doing media and press, James, I knew you'd just be champing at the bit.
No, but I like doing this. This is good because we can be free.
We can be free.
We're going to
play a couple of songs from your long catalogue, and
sure.
We're going to really break with convention in a James Rain interview and play something off your most recent release.
Oh my goodness, that will be great.
On vinyl, so I'm excited about that. But I'm just going to turn the clock back for you, and I know I'm trying to distinguish this from every other commercial radio interview you've done for the last 30 years, and all they want to do is talk about what you used to do.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So I am going to turn the clock back, and then we're going to kind of, you know, fast track it so that we get into a more contemporary version of James Rain. But I want to go back to, I guess, your earliest memories of music and what it was that really turned you on to the idea of music and it possibly even being something that might become your career.
Well, I think when I was about 11, I mean, I was aware of the Beatles and the, you know, things that were on the radio, but I think the first time I heard, I was probably about 11, hearing Creedence Clearwater Revival, I think it was the first time I heard that sound and I went, what is that? And that I wanted to. Not I want to do that, but that was the first sort of band that really made me excited enough to want to follow them and buy records and go out. And then it sort of turned me onto that, the idea of rock and roll and pop music. And so when there was a Brashers in Frankston, and I remember going down there and I bought, I think and also turned me onto just the idea of Australian music. And I bought, the first single I bought was a single called Lady Scorpio, by the Strangers, but then I bought Creedence Clearwater Revival's second album called Bayou Country, and that was the first time from memory that I really something really, you know, lit a spark.
How old were you?
Probably 11. It was probably,
which is an interesting age for a young person.
Yeah, 67, 68.
Getting a sense of perhaps making your own choices and musically making some choices that weren't about what mum and dad might have had on the radio or something like that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we were all aware of the Beatles and everything because it was just everywhere and associated with sort of the British, all those songs that were played. But I think they lodge in your subconscious somehow, because I wasn't probably consciously aware of them then, but since when I hear them now, I somehow know the words, you know, some early Holly song or something else.
It's true that. Is the sun always out when you think about those songs?
Yeah, I think so. I just think of the room in my house where I was a kid, my bedroom, where I'd play them. We had a little gramophone, you know, a little portable gramophone. You had to turn the knob to 45 and then back to 33 to play the albums.
And home in those days was Mount Eliza.
It was.
And you very much became, you were at Peninsula Grammar and you formed a group of friends. I think you went off to another school for a period of time too, didn't you?
I did my last year of school at another school, yes.
What was the other school?
The other school was Taylor's College in the city.
Why did you go there?
Because I think it was suggested, my mother hates this, but it was suggested that maybe my attitude wasn't, I wasn't told to leave, but I think it was more a matter of maybe if you were coming back, you might want to do a little attitude adjustment, perhaps, maybe, you know.
So you were quite self-assured even at an early age?
No, I don't have self-assured. It was 1974, and so I would have been 16, 17. Mm. I don't know. It was the time. I mean, people forget, as we remember, you know, the early 70s. There was a time of big change, and Vietnam was still going on, and there was all this sort of stuff. And I had friends whose older brothers were, you know, were about to be called up or called up. The moratoriums were on. There was a big in the air. There was sort of not revolution, but there was change in the air. I mean, people take the things that people take for granted now, and it sounds almost pretentious to say it, but things like women's liberation and, you know, the female eunuch had just recently come out, and the ideas like that didn't exist before then. So there was a lot of change going on. The Nation Review, I mean, dear Bob Ellis just died recently, you know, the Nation Review and all that sort of idea. And there were all these sort of things happening in, certainly north of the river, certainly in Carlton and the Pram Factory. And my group of friends and I was certainly really aware of it. We used to read the Nation Review and we were sort of aware of all that stuff and aspired to that sort of stuff. Never thought we'd be part of that. So that was the sort of, and we were going to a school that at that time, there were a couple of things that we thought were possibly relatively petty. This is no reflection on the school. I don't want to speak of the school. They're wonderful people. They're wonderful people, teachers and masters there who taught there and still are. You know, and it's just the times.
And I think it's the age. Yeah, and I think it's the age that you're at. You know, it's not. It's not quite. Yeah,
you know, we discovered, you know, all sorts of things.
So there was a period of time, and initially you were a drummer. When you're sort of thinking about being in bands, you were drumming and you know, thinking, oh, this is all right. I can just bang around here. This is fine.
Yeah, well, I don't think I was going to be in a band. I had a couple of boxes and I'd play at home and I'd just play along to Creedence Records with headphones on with the records. I went down, you plug the headphone in the side of the record player and I just play along and probably drove my parents nuts. And then the group of friends I had at school, when we were in probably form 3, 4, 5 around then, we just had a little band that we never played anywhere. We just played in our different parents' lounge rooms, you know. We just played along. We played blues, nothing but blues. Mm.
It's not a bad place to start. James Rain is with us. 3RPP is where you're at. Mm-hmm. And the Wordy Rapping Hood is the show. And we're going to start delving into your rich and wonderful musical catalogue in a minute, James. But at some point in the mid to late 70s, you regroup with your friends from Peninsula Grammar and a couple of others from town and you form a band called Australian Crawl.
Yes. We had a band earlier called Spiff Rauch.
Yep.
That was Spiff Rauch Mark II. There'd been a Spiff Rauch beforehand that I wasn't in. But then Bill and Guy McDonough, Guy was 2 years older than me and Bill was a couple of years older than Guy. I became friends with them. I knew them from school, but they were older than me, so you don't really know people when they're older. But I got to know them after school. And we'd all been in the swimming squad and we all swam and stuff. So I became friends with them after school and university and that sort of stuff. And we thought we'd start a little band called Spiff Rauch and we were together for about 10 months or something. Then that split up and then I wanted to keep staying. So I got with my friend Simon Binks and my other friend Brad Robinson and we knew a bass player called Paul Williams who'd filled in for Spiff Rauch once and we started that band. And my brother played the drums when we first started because I had a little kid at home and he'd start playing that.
And this was a period where Australian music was, I guess, really forming a voice. And that felt like having an Australian voice was a really important part of the bands at that time, and certainly Australian Crawl, which were part of that shaping of that sound. Were you conscious of that, or was that something that was just kind of, I guess, in the zeitgeist at the time?
We weren't conscious of it at all. Was certainly in the zeitgeist, but we were big fans. We were great big fans of a lot of bands in town, and that was the difference. We were sort of based down here. But, you know, bands in town, it seemed like this other world, and they were kind of, if it was came from town, it was cooler and hipper. And but we were big fans of the Polacco Brothers, and we had a friend, one of Guy's friends was crewed for the Polacco Brothers, so we felt connected. You know, Guy actually did know him, I didn't know him. And so we go and see the Polacco Brothers and then the Sports, and I'd been for years seeing bands. I went back, I used to see Spectrum and Aerial and all those sort of bands. I love those, and you know, even Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs, I was a big fan of Broderick Smith. I love the Dingoes, and I've cast them for that. And they used to come down to Frankston and do. There was a thing called Atmos 100 once on Frankston Oval, and I used to. Even when I was 16, I'd go along. I just loved all that stuff. So we just never thought we just thought, well, we just do a few gigs, and we used to hire halls down here, like the Tyab Hall and the local halls out in the bush, and you could hire them for, I don't forget, and you pay the $25, you could have a liquor license, which meant people could drink there, and we'd run our own shows. But we were not aware of trying to be Australian. I never thought we were as good as the people in town going, oh, we'd never be like them.
Well, in 1980, when the Boys Light Up album came out, yep. I can just tell you a little story, because I was in my final year at Toorak down here on the peninsula. Yeah. And on the cover was the most outrageously audacious thing that we'd really thought we were ever going to see, because a woman who'd gone through our school a couple of years before was on the front cover of this album.
Yeah.
She was the daughter of the English teacher.
Yeah.
And we knew her then as Tracy Martin. RPP listeners know her now as Tracy Bailey.
Correct.
Sally.
Sally Bailey.
Sister was Tracy. Sally Bailey, Sally Martin, from Arts About here at RPP. And I have to say, this was the most kind of just wildly wonderful and slightly like, oh, this is a bit naughty. And these guys came from Peninsula, and there was an incredible connection, and there was an incredible sense of the time and being connected to something that was just a little bit outside what we actually
Sally
already
was naked on the front. There she was.
Sally naked on the cover. So let's just do this for a minute, shall we? From the 1980 album Played Off Vinyl, an album I probably bought at Frankston Brashes.
$5.95
that I bought in especially for the occasion.
It's in good nick.
It's not in bad nick, which probably means I didn't cane it that much.
No, that's right.
The Boys Light Up is the song. James Rain is our guest here on 3RPP, and he has just come back into the studio after kind of running screaming from the studio at the thought of having to revisit this.
The song, it's just the singing's terrible.
That was not that bad.
It was the first time in the studio, really, and I just, you know, it's barely controlled yelling, really.
Well, it's done pretty well for you, and it is a song that is, I guess, part of the very much the Peninsula lexicon. It's a huge part of the soundtrack.
Lyrically,
of
it was all about where I was grew up. Yeah.
And hugely important, I think, for putting the Peninsula, I guess, musically on the map. I think for those of us who were here at that time, we sort of really felt like, wow, this song's written about the Peninsula.
Yeah.
And this James Rain and this band, Australian Crawl, felt very much like a Peninsula band. String of hits, constant touring, till about the mid-80s, incredible success, top of the pops for that period of time.
Right.
Just in a nutshell, just kind of revisit that time, what that was like, and then I guess the ultimate sort of burning out of the band as well.
Well, I think it's almost a classic story. You sort of don't remember too much about it. You remember sort of specific, certain things that happened. But I don't really remember having any great sense of, wow, this is, because when you're doing it, you're just doing it, you know. And I remember you could work a lot. I think we'd work 6 times a week, 10 months, 11 months a year. But there were a lot of other bands around at that time. And it was just a very different environment then. Radio, you know, mainstream rock and roll radio was supportive, and the agencies were supportive, and there were lots of venues. So there were us and the Cold Chisel and Split Enz and all the bands that everyone would think of that time were all working constantly all the time. So my main memory is of being in cars, I think. You do a lot of driving.
And then at a certain point, after lots and lots of touring, the band breaks up in 1986-ish.
I think so, early 86, yeah.
What happened?
Just the things that happen with bands. You spend so much time together and, you know, little things become big things, and things that probably, with the benefit of hindsight, you look back on, you think, well, if we hadn't done that, maybe we could. I don't know. You just don't know at the time. And There are all sorts of things that happen in bands. You know, if someone writes more songs than somebody else, they're going to make more money than somebody else. So that sometimes gets in the way. Or you try and, I mean, a lot of the bands that seem to stay together for a long time have worked out, you know, that certain people are good at certain things and certain people are better at other things. They're all those sort of things and the little petty stupidities and become, you know, just all those things. And then you think, well, you'd rather maintain a friendship than beat each other's throats. And then you just move on. I mean, you genuinely, when you hear, not musical differences, but people move on and you grow. And we knew each other from when we were, you know, really early teens. Brad and I knew each other from when we were 8, but Brad and I maintained a great friendship, always. And Guy was a great friend of mine and we maintained a great friendship. But you grow up, and as we all do, you're a different person when you're 25 and 26 to when you were 17. You're just a different person.
Hold that thought. 25 past 12, 3RPP, the voice of the peninsula, the Wordy Rapping Hood is the show. James Rain is my guest on this inaugural Wordy Rapping Hood show. Tracy Hutchison is my name. Let's pay some bills and come back. 3RPP is the station that you tune to. James Rain is our guest here on the Mornington Peninsula. Tracy Hutchison here with you on the Wordy Rapping Hood. And we're taking a trip through the life and times of James Rain, as is the wont of this program, the Wordy Rapping Hood. And James, we were picking up just at the point where the Australian Crawl have broken up.
Mm-hmm.
You've decided it's time to move on. And you move on to Los Angeles and London. So you divide your time really through that period between LA and London, and have some incredible times recording with people like Olivia Newton-John, working on demos with people like Ian Dury, even turning up on something, and I remember this from the Jays, a French singer called Lizzie Mercier-Desclus, contributing some songwriting.
Yep.
What was that time like? Because from Australia, it felt like you were very much estranged from the person you were in Australia. Australian Crawl, and you'd literally gone, I don't want to be that person.
Yep.
I'm going over here. What's your reflection and recollection of that time?
Pretty much that. I didn't want to be that person. I was sick of James Rain, and I wanted to get out, not of Australia, but I wanted to get away from that. And I had some demos, and I went to LA, and I had a couple of phone numbers, and within 2 weeks I had a management. I got some management with Roger Davies, who was he's not expatriate, but he's Australian. Manager was looking after Olivia and Tina Turner, and they listened to my demos and said, yes, we'd like to represent you. And I was lucky enough, they got me a record deal with Capitol Records in LA. But I lived in London because I have a British passport, so I could live in London and go back to LA. And I met someone in New York. She was French, so she could live in London as well. So we lived in London, and I just commuted. And I made my first solo record there with a guy called David Sigerson producing it.
And what was your feeling about Australia during that time? Did you think about it at all, or were you very much thinking, I don't want to think about
it? I was not going to come. I thought I'll let fate take a chance, and I thought I'll go away, and if I end up being a greengrocer in Peabody, Idaho, so be it. But I had these demos. Obviously, I wanted to keep doing music. I thought the demos were good. I thought there were good songs on it. And I just wanted to see what would happen. So I went away and I saved a bit of money. And I thought, I'll just see what happens. And I'll just let fate, you know, take me where it takes me.
Eventually, though, fate brought you home.
Yeah.
After about a decade or so, wasn't it? It was quite a long time away.
I was away for 2 years.
Ah, it felt like longer.
Yeah, well, I made the record in Los Angeles, the first solo record, and then I came back to tour because it was released here, and I was lucky enough that it did really well here, so I came back here to tour, and I had a deal directly with Capitol Records, and I remember there was the week before it was going to be released in America, and I was taken out to lunch, I think, nearly every day of that week with all the bigwigs from Capitol going, this is going to be a smash, we're going to get all these ads for radio, and we're going to get 250 ads, and I was sitting, for stupid me, naive me, thinking, oh my God, this might actually work. And of course, it did come out a week later, they got 30 ads. It went top 10 in Boston and top 10 in Miami for about 2 weeks, and then it was all over. It was that quick. I think they thought they'd get all these radio ads, which is how it worked then, on the first week. They didn't get them. Okay, second week, they got 20 more on the second week, and then they just dropped the bundle and get onto somebody else. That's how quick it is. It was 2 weeks. And they'd spent quite a bit of money making the record.
How did you cope with that, given that you had experienced
an incredible ride during Australian Call, the kind of ride that a lot of bands never have.
Mm.
And so you've had this incredible success in your home patch.
Yep.
You go away, you come back. You've moved on, the country hasn't particularly.
Well, I came back because the country was very kind of me because the record worked here.
Mm. But then it didn't have the success that you'd had before. So how did that feel for you?
In Australia, it did. In Australia, it's the first three solo records that I made had about the same sort of success that Australian Crawl had had in terms of, you know, record sales. And I mean, there are more. I probably had more successful singles in the solo years than we actually, because we'd sell a lot. We'd always have successful albums. I mean, we had a couple of singles that went quite well with Australian Crawl, but there were more singles that were successful in the solo thing. So I don't know how it works, but I certainly, look, I toured as well, but I'd keep going back to LA and back to London. I'd come back here and tour to make enough money to be able to go back and live back over there.
Mm, which I think created a bit of an impression that you didn't like us very much in Australia.
No, I love everybody and I love Australia, but I had a girlfriend over there and I was working with people like Lizzie, and there were just more opportunities to do some other things over there. But Australia is funny how they sort of go, not good enough for us. I mean, you know, you made a record in LA. No, just wanted to do it. You know, we make just as good records here. There was a bit of it.
This is one of them. This did pretty well
for
you.
Acoustic version.
This is an acoustic version of a song called
Slave.
James Rain on 3RPP. The 2004 acoustic version of Slave.
Yes.
From James Rain. Who's singing with you?
Me.
Are you backing vocal in yourself?
I'm singing with myself.
And don't you sing beautifully?
Well, that's very kind, Trace, but I think, you know, I worked out how to be a singer. The difference between the first record and now. Now I can sort of sing.
Sing beautifully.
Thank you very much. That's funny because people just say, oh, geez, you know, the one pet thing's... But I had the phrase in the tip of my tongue and I've forgotten it.
25 minutes to 12, RPPFM, the voice of the peninsula. Tracy Hutchison here. The Wordy Rapping Hood is the show. James Rain is our guest. And it is great to have your company on this Friday, 3RPP. Tracy Hutchison, The Wordy Rapping Hood is the show. And James Rain is our inaugural guest on a show that week by week is going to profile all the wonderful, fabulously talented creatives and tremendous people that live in this neck of the woods that
and
we all love.
There are many of them.
Call home.
Yeah.
You, James, you came back to Australia but didn't just sort of come home. I know there was a period of living in Sydney, but you found your way back to the Mornington Peninsula to call home. What was it about this patch that you thought, this is where I feel best?
Well, having Molly, my daughter, and we just thought that this is a great place for someone to grow up, and there are great schools here, and... Yeah, it's just the coastal culture that is down here, the landscape, the coast, the countryside. It's just, you know, it's got it all, and it's just a great place for kids to grow up. So when Molly was born, I think we moved down here when she was about 6 months old. So she's grown up here. She's now nearly 17. So she spent her life. It's just been great for me. I've rediscovered the peninsula, having, you know, lived in lots of other places, and we've been here now for 16-17 years, but you know, and absolutely love it.
When we played The Boys Light Up at the beginning of the program, I almost had to physically restrain you from leaving the studio, because revisiting that time for you and those songs for you is still something that I think is a bit of a challenge, making friends, reconciling that phase of your career and that version of James Rain, because they are the songs that you hear in Richie's Supermarket, and you can often be in there when those songs are happening.
And someone will always say, yeah, give us a tune, mate. Yeah.
How does that go for you?
Well, I've actually reconciled myself with it. I've done a couple of tours where I've done sort of called it all the hits. So we do the Crawl hits, solo stuff. People love it. They sell really well. They sell out. Lots of people come. People go crazy. They sing all the songs. And except for a few, there are a few exceptions, but most of the songs I come to terms with. I mean, a song like Boys Light Up, I still think lyrically I'm proud of it. It's just the way I sing it. That's what kind of just the, I can't hear myself that version. I can't listen to the so-called singing because it's not singing. It's just awful. But I think I sing it properly now because I can call myself a singer now. I'm still learning. But it's not so much, I think it's more my performance that of some songs. Some of the songs I just really just go, oh, come on, seriously. And again, one forgets that a couple of those songs, you know, were written, I mean, except a couple of the ones I wrote when I was probably 17 years old, and now I'm not 17. I'm a lot older than 17. And you look back, not Boys Light Up and not Reckless and those things, but I look back some of the ones on those first few albums, just think, oh, seriously. And
it's, would that be Hoochie Coochie, yeah, Fiorucci Mama?
So, yeah, that thing. And I just
Everyone was wearing Fiorucci jeans though, James.
They were.
That was and exactly Gucci. What it was about.
That's right. And people want to hear it, and I do occasionally still do it, but I get the crowd to sing along. There are a couple of lines in there I just can't stand. But that's a 17-year-old just trying too hard. You know, some of it's okay, but some of it is just, some of the lines are just, you know, 17-year-old going, please take me seriously.
With lines like that.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Lyrically, though, you've always really worked really hard lyrically on your work, on your creative work, and it's always been a really important part of what you've brought to your songwriting, a really intelligent approach to songwriting.
Well, certainly in the last 15, 20 years, I've been like every song. I mean, there are a couple of songs that go, oh, that just repeat the first verse and that'll do.
Mm.
Yeah, but I mean, certainly since, you know, the mid-90s, I've really, you know, wanted to make it so it reads well on the page.
Mm. Yeah. We're going to do something that could actually be a first for a James Rain interview, because we're actually going to play something off your latest release.
Wow.
Which I know is just groundbreaking.
Yes, that's.
And it's on vinyl, so which is wonderful, because we both love vinyl, you and I, and we've watched with great interest in the rebirth of vinyl, because we've still got our vinyl.
Yeah.
But the track, the album, the EP that you've most recent released, tell us a little bit about this before we hear a song from it.
Okay, this is me and the band that I've played with forever and ever, who played with me. That record, we just called it Me and the Magnificent, James Rain and the Magnificent Few. And we made old school. I had some songs. I went into the rehearsal studio. We just went to our rehearsal studio, and I just played the songs to them on acoustic guitar and said, everybody, bring what you bring to this. So we did it old school band style and went in and recorded it.
You know, I'm almost tempted to say, geez, mate, you haven't lost it.
Yeah, well, that's...
Except you'd punch me.
That's right. That's the thing. That's the phrase people say. Geez, mate, you haven't lost it. You're good.
Yeah, well, James Rain off a brand new record on vinyl, James Rain and the Magnificent Few. It's a 6-track, the old-fashioned mini album.
Yeah.
With some incredible artwork on the cover. A tourist man holding an old school wooden surfboard. And that track was What a Pain in the Ass It Is to Run Into You Again. It's absolutely not that at all, James. It's incredible pleasure. And I feel so lucky to be spending this hour with you talking about your life and being so generous about your life and times that's brought you back to this beautiful place on the Mornington Peninsula.
Well, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
12 minutes away from 1 o'clock. So we are sort of getting toward the end of this inaugural edition of the Wordy Rapping Hood. And James Rain has been a very generous first guest. And I guess hearing that new record of yours and knowing that you're still out on the road, knowing that you're still doing lots of different things, what keeps you going creatively, given that you have to, I guess, juggle the creative spirit that you were at 16, 17 when you were writing songs that you're still playing and now still delivering new work? What keeps you going creatively?
I just like doing it, and it sounds pretentious to say you have a need. I just do it. You know, it's what I do, and I do it. And I know that most of the time I make these records and less, you know, because radio won't play them. But I just do it. I've got lots and lots of songs. I've got about 8 new songs that I'm working on now. Some are finished, some are close to finished, some are less than finished. But it's just what I do, and I read. And I've written other things. My brother and I have written a television. I mean, I've got fingers in lots of pies, you know. Mm. But it's, as we've often said, you know, you just get on with it. What you said, you don't sit around waiting for other people to sort of give you the green light or say, yes, you can do this. You just get on with it.
Mm.
And it's what I do. You know, it's what I like to do. It's what I feel impelled to do to a certain extent.
Mm.
And I just like reading and writing. Sorry.
You mentioned radio won't play it because radio, for the most part, is probably only interested in the James Rain that you used to be as opposed to the James Rain you are.
Mainstream commercial radio. The ABC are great. You know, yeah. The community radio is fantastic. You know, I've got a great relationship with lots of community radio, especially this one.
Do you think you've made friends with that James Rain that you ran away from for a period of your life?
I guess I don't think about him, you know. He's just, I don't know. I know I was there because people tell me and it's recorded that I was there. But, yeah, I think he was probably a bit of a loudmouth and, he was probably... I think there's some great quote, I can't remember it, but I think anyone, when they suddenly they get some sort of profile, they're allowed a year to be insufferable.
How many years did you get over yourself. How many years did
I probably went 18 months.
This has been just a treat. You are about to go out on the road with your good friend Mark Seymour,
yep,
who also
Mark.
Calls the
yep.
Peninsula home and
he
is also on my list of go-tos. So if you're listening, Mark, I'll be on the phone shortly. Mark Seymour, late of Hunters and Collectors, of course, but now very much and in lots of ways had a very similar parallel career to yours,
yep.
James. So
yes.
it's kind of always great to see you two on a bill together. We were talking about songs that you have found that you've been able to revisit quite comfortably and other songs that have been a real struggle to revisit, but you know that that's what your fans want to hear.
Yeah.
And I think one of the songs that has been, I guess, more contentious for you to reconcile is Reckless. Which I just think is, not just because you're sitting here, but is just such a great song. And I'm wondering at what point whether you've actually made friends with that song or whether Paul Kelly doing a cover of that song helped you think it was a good song, like someone else's treatment of it.
I wasn't even aware he'd done it until someone, I went along and I saw him. But it's not that I haven't had to reconcile it. I never thought it was that good because it sort of wrote itself. And I always was one of those songs I thought, I've got to fix the lyrics on that song because they don't make any sense or they don't hang together or something. But since then, I don't know, you sort of with the benefit of hindsight, like so many things in life, I guess you look back at it. But it's a lot of songs that become so-called standards or get this sort of status. Yeah, it just becomes a thing, you know. I think of other songs that become sort of. I mean, Mark's. I'm sure Mark's relationship, Mark Seymour's relationship with Throw Your Arms Around Me, and Mark might have a similar kind of thing. You just go, oh, what happened? Why does suddenly that one become the one that people go, wow, that's the song? And if you've written it, sometimes you don't hear it yourself because you're too close to it or you can't be objective. I just hear it and go, okay, it seems okay, but people seem to go nuts when you play it.
It's the
keeps
song
turning up on lists
of greatest songs of all time, greatest Australian top 100 songs.
I have a theoretical figure: if you hang around long enough, they're going to give you something. You know,
this is the song that you have fondly dubbed the shopping list song,
yeah.
And I don't know whether or not that's something that you want to elaborate on, but we have talked about this before.
Yeah, there have been times, not anymore, of course. Anyone who comes and see us, I don't do that anymore because I'm lost in the song because I think it's so wonderful. But if I have done the song and gone right, I've got to get cheese, I've got to get beans, I've got to get washing powder while I'm singing it. It sings itself a bit. They're allowed a year to be insufferable.
How many years did you get over yourself.
I probably went 18 months.
This has been just a treat. You are about to go out on the road with your good friend Mark Seymour,
yep,
who also
Mark.
Calls the
yep.
Peninsula home and
he
is
does.
Also on my list of go-tos. So if you're listening, Mark, I'll be on the phone shortly. Mark Seymour, late of Hunters and Collectors, of course, but now very much and in lots of ways had a very similar parallel career to yours,
yep.
James. So
yes.
it's kind of always great to see you two on a bill together. We were talking about songs that you have found that you've been able to revisit quite comfortably and other songs that have been a real struggle to revisit, but you know that that's what your fans want to hear.
Yeah.
And I think one of the songs that has been, I guess, more contentious for you to reconcile is Reckless. Which I just think is, not just because you're sitting here, but is just such a great song. And I'm wondering at what point whether you've actually made friends with that song or whether Paul Kelly doing a cover of that song helped you think it was a good song, like someone else's treatment of it.
Maybe that sort of, I wasn't even aware he'd done it until someone, I went along and I saw him. But it's not that I haven't had to reconcile it. I never thought it was that good because it sort of wrote itself. And I always, was one of those songs I thought, I've got to fix the lyrics on that song because they don't make any sense or they don't hang together or something. But since then, I don't know, you sort of, with the benefit of hindsight, like so many things in life, I guess you look back at it. But it's a lot of songs that become so-called standards or get this sort of status. Yeah, it just becomes a thing, you know. I think of other songs that become sort of, I mean, Mark's, I'm sure Mark's relationship, Mark Seymour's relationship with Throw Your Arms Around Me, and I don't, you know, Mark might have a similar kind of thing. You just go, oh, what happened? Why does suddenly that one become the one that people go, wow, that's the song? And, you know, if you've written it, sometimes you don't hear it yourself because you're too close to it or you can't be objective. I just hear it and go, okay, it seems okay. But people seem to go nuts when you play it.
It's the
keeps
song
turning up on lists
of greatest songs of all time, greatest Australian
well, you know,
top 100.
I have a theoretical figure: if you hang around long enough, they're going to give you something. You know,
this is the song that you have fondly dubbed the shopping list song, and I don't know whether or not that's something that you know you want to elaborate on. But we have talked about this before.
Yeah, there have been times, not anymore, of course. Anyone who comes and see us, I don't do that anymore because I'm lost in the song because I think it's so wonderful. But if I have done the song and gone right, I've got to get cheese, I've got to get beans, I've got to get washing powder while I'm singing it. You know, it sings itself a bit. Me, that was James Rain singing Reckless, which is a song I wrote once upon a time, a long time ago.
3RPPFM is where you are, the voice of the peninsula. James Rain is here, and we're coming up to news at 1 o'clock. Then Jack Beamish will be on the wireless with Jazz Spectrum for this Friday afternoon. Do you remember where you were when you wrote Reckless?
Yeah, I remember the first bit was I was filming Return to Eden, and I was sitting on a slope while they were setting up something, and I had my guitar, and I actually watched a ferry go by, and they used to have those pontoons floating, so they move with the water. The jetty landing, so that's just right as I saw it.
We didn't even talk about your acting career, the whole sort of
Return to Eden. That's the careers are very using the term very loosely.
How many series did you do in the end?
I did Return to Eden. I did State Coroner. I was in the Tina Turner movie. Yeah, I went Hollywood. Don't worry.
And you've come here to the Mornington Peninsula.
Correct.
Where
Hollywood to home.
Hollywood to home.
And I tell you, it's much nicer here than in Hollywood.
James Rain, thank you so much for being the first guest on The Wordy Repping Hood. It's been great to have your company and taking us through the last however many decades of your life. Yeah.
Thank you, Trace. It's been lovely to be here.
Yeah, and I look forward to your company here on RPPFM this time next Friday.